Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Gar Alperovitz, who is an historian, political economist, activist, writer, and government official. He is currently a professor of political economy at the University of Maryland and is a former fellow of King's College, Cambridge University, Harvard's Institute of Politics, and a guest scholar at the Brookings Institution. He also serves as legislative director in the United States House of Representatives and the United States Senate and as a special assistant in the Department of State. He is the co-founder of the Democracy Collaborative at the University of Maryland and a member of the board of directors of New Economic Institute. His most recent books include America Beyond Capitalism and Unjust Deserts. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gar Alperovitz.
Glad to be with you, Ian.
And what was your sense of the two conventions? It struck me as being a little odd that the Republicans, who are famous for running the trains on time and being precise and disciplined, seem to have a bit of a train wreck. And comparatively speaking, the Democrats had a fairly efficient and well-timed and fairly effective convention.
Well, I think that's right. Although the Republicans traditionally have been efficient, but the Romney campaign has made mistake after mistake after mistake. So it's not surprising, I suppose, that they would, you know, have a number of missteps in this convention. The most obvious one was the empty chair, Clint Eastwood story. But Obama's, I thought, Romney's speech, even his wife's speech, which were well prepared and well said, didn't have the punch that you might have expected they'd try for in a convention of this kind.
Well, I think the broader question is why are they doing so well if they are so inept, and if we are essentially in this kind of post 2008 economy that was caused by excess and greed on Wall Street, and here they are running an exemplar of the 1%.
Not only an exemplar of the 1%, a person who seems so self-evidently contradictory. I mean, he's taken positions over the time of his life, you know, on every side of every issue. And I don't think he can get away from that. That is to say, he was certainly for free choice, and then he's against it. And he's taken a strong view that he's morally the right guy on a number of subjects, and he's back and forth. I think his own constituencies, even the conservatives, you know, doubt him and distrust him simply because of who he is and his position.
So why is he doing running, you know, not level, but close to being even? He's a few points behind, apparently, in most of the polls.
Well, there's a couple of things I think, you know, again, this is conventional wisdom, although there's been some really interesting analysis of the poll data, which we can go into recently. You know, number one is the obvious thing. The most obvious thing is the economy is not moving forward as fast as we'd like. But I think the subtext is racial. I think there is a strong body of the, you know, Americans, you know, not only white working men, but those are the people who are usually talked about. But I think there's a, you know, subgroup that really, not only in the South, but in places like Ohio and even, you know, Illinois, Wisconsin, where I'm from, don't want to elect a black man. They may not say it that way, but I think that's a big drain on the unemployment, and race, I think, are the dominant factors. But race is, I think, a bigger one than most people say, because you can't get it on the polls. People won't say what they feel, but I suspect that's very important.
But the American people did elect a black man in 2008, Gar Alperovitz. They elected him by a substantial margin, and they also, the Democrats, swept in the House and the Senate.
Well, it's true, but they had came in after a massive financial crisis collapsed the Republican position, and their candidate wasn't a very good candidate, and he failed to deal with the crisis. He was, you know, trying to exploit the financial breakdown, but he didn't do very well with it. So I think that, look, people, Obama's a likable character. There was a huge, young people were very enthusiastic for him. But he also was very lucky that the crisis happened just before Election Day. And I think on that basis, they weren't going to re-elect a Republican group in the face of that. So I think he's both very likable at that point. He had a lot of enthusiasm, but he also had this financial crisis that I think opened the door for the big vote.
Well, but arguably the fact that he's in trouble now and the people that voted for him in 2008 aren't sufficiently aroused or motivated this time around. Do you think that, Garapovich, do you think that has something to do with the fact that that a lot of people thought in when he came in 2009 that we were going to have a modern New Deal, that they believed him when he promised change, you know? And essentially what happened was Wall Street was bailed out, the people who caused the crisis were made whole, and we're still struggling. And, you know, these latest jobs numbers helping Romney. I don't understand why we didn't have a new deal given the absolute disgraceful behavior of Wall Street.
Oh, I'm with you on that entirely. I mean, what I would like to have seen, and we were talking just up till now, we've been talking about the polling data and why it worked one way or the other and what the odds are, horse race questions. But in terms of policy, one, I think the stimulus was totally inadequate. And I don't fault the politician when he doesn't have political space to maneuver in. He just can't. But I think Obama did, at the beginning, have both the House, the Senate, a big mandate. He had a mandate. He had a huge electoral win. He could have doubled the stimulus. And if he'd done that, he wouldn't be in the economic problems he's now facing. And I think he could have taken on the banks head on. And they knew it when he summoned 13 big bankers to the White House. And they were shaking in their boots. And what they found out was Obama said, well, fellas, let's see if we can work together. What do you want? And I'm exaggerating. But he didn't challenge he took the advice of his Secretary of Treasury, Geithner. What we need is build their confidence rather than take them on and start healing. On both those fronts, I think certainly my policy would have been different. It would have been much more aggressive and much more progressive. I think he had space to maneuver to do that. And it did not do that. So on the policy front, I think we could have had really the banks taken on. We could have had a much bigger and much more progressive stimulus program, plus the health care. And also he would be at this point in time, in my opinion, with a much more booming economy if he had really come in with that kind of a program. And I think he would have looked very good in the election. I think he still will get by. And it's amazing that he's going to get by with the weak economy he has. He's a very lucky man to get a very weak, I think, person on the other side who is so obviously doesn't have much trust, kind of trustworthiness. So it's an interesting situation. But I do think the odds are, if you look at the latest polling data carefully, most people are predicting Obama and maybe even a substantial Obama win.
Again,
one of the interesting things about that, which I just noticed, is that the Republicans and the Republican, these other huge funders for the campaigns buying all television have stopped buying. These are the conservative ones have stopped buying ads in Ohio, Michigan, and Wisconsin, which means that they think it's not a good investment. Which means that that the Democrats are likely, in their judgment, in the Romney side of the judgment of the Romney people, is that they're likely to lose Ohio, Michigan, and Wisconsin, which is very interesting.
Again, I'm speaking with Gar Apovitz, who's a historian, political economist, activist, writer, and government official. He's currently a professor of political economy at the University of Maryland and is a former fellow of King's College, Cambridge University, Harvard's Institute of Politics, and a guest scholar at the Brookings Institution. He also serves as legislative director in the United States House of Representatives and the United States Senate, and as a special assistant in the Department of State. He's co-founder of the Democracy Collaborative at the University of Maryland and is a member of the board of directors of the New Economic Institute. And his most recent books include America Beyond Capitalism and Unjust Deserts. The Politico is reporting from sources inside the Romney campaign that the Romney campaign have realized their internal polling have told them that they're way behind, or not way behind, but substantially behind in Ohio and Colorado, and that they're not in good shape. So that certainly buttresses what you've just told us, Gar Alperovitz. But in general, what explains, though, the fact that President Obama did not make the bold decisions at the time when he had the political power and momentum to do so? The conventional wisdom there is that it was the Obama campaign's dependence on money from the financial sector, from Wall Street, that restrained him.
Well, I think that was a piece of the puzzle. But when you look at it more carefully, I think the overwhelming thing that we all tend to forget, and think about Bill Clinton, who had been a governor for 12 years. Obama truly was a very, very inexperienced person. He'd been a member of legislatures in Illinois and a couple of years in the Senate, had never been in a position to run a government. He didn't really know the issues internally. He was highly dependent on experts, or people he thought were experts, like Geithner. And he took that advice. And the other piece about it, which is Obama is a cautious man. He's a moderate. So those are the two things that I think together: lack of experience, dependence on quote experts, many of whom came from the Clinton era, and then it's essentially his own moderation. And the way he got to be, all of his successes historically, the way he got to be head of the Harvard Business Review, Law Review, was a moderate bringing together of conservatives and liberals and that style, which a lot of Americans like that style, a moderate bringing together of people. I think all of that together brought him to the decision, instead of to take advantage of his huge mandate and to be, a very progressive program, which was possible. I think all of that conspired against it, and the result is what we've got.
Would we have been better off with Hillary Clinton?
I suspect Hillary, having been, the wife of a governor for 12 years, having been in the Senate much, much, much longer, and having been, in the White House for 8 years with her husband, probably would have been tougher on some of these issues. Whether or not she would have bowed to the conventional wisdom, it's hard to tell. She wasn't, a terribly progressive politician herself, but it's conceivable her experience level might have let her know that she was up against, she said, vast right-wing conspiracy, and she might have known that she had to take them on rather than try to cut a deal with them, as Obama did on the stimulus program, giving the Republicans more than 30% of the program for tax cuts that essentially were wasted.
Well, yeah, she probably would have had the same economic team, I guess. So, Gar Alperovitz, what do you make of the irony here that the Romney campaign running on the old Bill Clinton, James Carville 1992 campaign, it's the economy, stupid? So what do you think of that strategy, and what possible counter-strategies could the president have, given the history of how presidents dealing with economies as bad as this simply don't get reelected?
Well, Republicans are right to do that. I mean, that's their one. Look, Romney doesn't have a foreign policy. He's just not, the president and Clinton and are right about that. He just has no experience whatsoever, so he can't run on it. And not only that, at least the wars are slowly beginning to end, and Osama bin Laden's been killed. And, there's a lot of lots of headlines that may or may not be reflective of there's still a lot of troops in Afghanistan, and we're still bombing a lot of people. But nonetheless, in terms of public relations, Obama has a positive position. Romney can't run on foreign policy. He's a businessman. It's obvious he's trying to claim that being essentially a business raider gives him the possibility of being a good economic manager for the country, and this big it's normal that they would take this on, and they want to stay away from the hot issues that the, you know, that their own constituents want, the abortion and women's rights and stuff, because of the they know that those positions are dangerous in the suburbs and they'll vote. So what's left is the economy. It's amazing that Obama's doing so well, given the economic pain out there. But I think it's attributable partly to a bad campaign and partly to the fact that, you know, the auto rescue probably was extremely important, not so much nationally, but, you know, elections, look at the Electoral College, it's Michigan, Ohio, some of Wisconsin, some of Illinois, some of Pennsylvania. That's the heart of the voting piece of the puzzle that he's got to put together state by state by state. And in those states, he's coming back. The economy is coming back. And so he's looking, whereas nationally the economy isn't doing that well, in the states that really count for a Democratic electoral victory, he's doing much, much better than most people realize economically.
And it certainly didn't help that he wrote that op-ed criticizing the bailout.
You're talking about Romney, right?
Romney, yeah, exactly. I mean,
yeah. There's a, yeah, I agree with you. There's a really interesting poll study with, I don't know if you make Nate Silver in 538. He's analyzed all the polls since the Democratic convention. Many of them are tracking polls, which means that there are 7 days and half the polling data is before. So, you know, with no boost from the convention. So if you analyze it and figure out, because he got a point, you know, 4-point boost in the tracking polls, and he was way low before the convention, which means he probably got about a 10-point boost from the convention, which is an extraordinary boost compared with the Republican convention. That if you do the algebra, some of them comes out, one comes out 10.5, another one comes out just under 9, another one comes out 8-point boost. So something happened at the convention in terms of also crystallizing some of these ideas. You know, he's predicting, Nate Silver's predicting 316 electoral votes for, you know, almost an overwhelming electoral victory. But I think that's a little unlikely. But the likelihood of an Obama victory, at least in these polls and at this point in time, and given that the Republicans apparently are getting up on Ohio, Michigan, and Wisconsin, there's a reasonable forecast, and I always take that with a grain of salt, but that's the current polling data.
Again, I'm speaking with Gaur Apovitz, who's a historian, political economist, activist, writer, and government official. He's currently a professor of political economy at the University of Maryland and is a former fellow of King's College, Cambridge University, Harvard's Institute of Politics, and a guest scholar at the Brookings Institution. He also serves as legislative director in the United States House of Representatives and the United States Senate, and as a special assistant in the Department of State. He's co-founder of the Democracy Collaborative at the University of Maryland and is a member of the board of directors of the New Economic Institute, and his most recent books include America Beyond Capitalism and Unjust Deserts. So
I should just make clear that those, when many years ago, which I was in the government working on the House for liberals and the House and Senate, and then the UN part of the State Department, those are past, and I'm no longer doing that.
Right. No, that is your past, but it's somewhat illustrious past, even if the House and Senate today are extremely unpleasant places to be, which leads me to this question of gridlock. If, as you predict and Nate Silver predicts, that the president is way ahead at least in the Electoral College and is likely to win, what's he going to be dealing with? Isn't there going to be even worse gridlock? Because the money that's pouring in, all of our attention's on the presidential race, but the money that's pouring in the Senate and House races through Karl Rove's and other super PACs and these 501c4s, where the donors have to disclose who they are. My understanding that people like the Koch brothers are really targeting the House and Senate because, you know, that's where they'll get their, you know, breaks.
Oh, I think that's right. Not only the House and Senate, but the House and Senate state by state by state within the state governments as well. They're building for the long haul. We're just talking about the horse race question of winning the presidency, which obviously is important. But I think the deeper reality is what I think you're pointing to is we are in a position of systemic stalemate and decay. I think people look at the politics is important. I mean, it does matter who is president. But I think in terms of the fundamental trends, the income inequality has been growing steadily now for 30 years. Environmental issues, for the most part, have gotten worse for 30 years. The social and economic decay is developing, and the bridges are falling down. If you talk to people or look at what's going on with what one in three black kids is now growing up in poverty, the poverty rate does not change or gets worse. We are in a fundamental, if you look at systemically, the long trends in almost every area that counts, civil liberties being another, global warming being another, the long 30-year trends tell you that something much deeper is going on with corporate capitalism. And the fact is that the lockup in the House and Senate with conservatives, I think, represents much deeper issues as well, which means that you can't change the trends much, no matter who's president, and no matter how the Congress is organized with the Koch brothers buying them, but it represents much deeper power relationships. One of the big, big, big things that's happened is that the system used to be not balanced, but slightly kept in line because you had a strong labor movement. It was just under 35% of the labor force was organized in the 1950s. Now it's down to 7% in the private sector, a little bit under, actually. And roughly 11% total. So the whole blocking force that kept corporate capitalism in line and stabilized these decaying trends, that's gone. It's on the way out, and that means that the whole system is being moved to the right with the resulting pain and social and economic depression, and I think we're paving the way for really fundamental crisis in the system and the need to look at, if you don't like corporate capitalism and you don't like state socialism, how do we begin thinking about this as the prehistory of the next great systemic transformation, the next great era? I think that's what's opening up in the real world, quite apart from the horse race of politics. I'd still rather have a Democrat in office because you can soften the edges of the systemic transition. But nonetheless, I think much deeper issues are going to be there, and the blockages you see in the House and Senate just represent this underlying power change at the level of the system, corporate power and labor power and race. The underlying issues, I think, are moving in that direction.
Well, just in closing, Guy Rapovitz, it would seem to me that what the president should have said in the convention is he should have drawn those lines about the incipient plutonomy and the capture of our politics by oligarchs. There was a brief mention to voter suppression and the super PACs buying the elections. But that's the story, isn't it?
Well, it is the deeper story, and they were very light on that side. But you're not going to get presidents talking about the deeper systemic issues. Their job, as they see it, is at this point in time is trying to keep the thing in balance, and they worry about how you hold together the pieces of a fraying puzzle. The job is our job, that is, people who care about these things, to make this happen and to raise the issues in a much deeper way and begin to not only build a political movement, which we need to do, but build a political movement with some deeper ideas and transformations in mind. I mean, for instance, there's worker-owned companies are beginning to be set up around the country out of the pain. We're beginning to see some states, 20 states, are beginning to talk about building publicly owned banks like North Dakota. That's the kind of stuff that's happening. 25% of American electricity is now under city, municipal, socialized city or co-ops. Really building the basis of a different vision. That's our job. Presidents will do what they're going to do. We can push them, but our job is to really change the vision, build for the long haul, because there are much deeper problems that no politician is going to touch until we make them touch it.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Guy Rapovitz.
Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Again, I've been speaking with Guy Rapovitz, who's an historian, political economist, activist, writer, and government official. He's currently and former government official. He's currently a professor of political economy at the University of Maryland and a former fellow at King's College, Cambridge University, Harvard's Institute for Politics, and a guest scholar at the Brookings Institution. He previously served as a legislative director in the United States House of Representatives and the U.S. Senate, and as a special assistant in the Department of State. He's the co-founder of the Democracy Collaborative at the University of Maryland and a member of the board of directors of the New Economic Institute. His most recent books include America Beyond Capitalism and Unjust Deserts. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back joined by historian Jefferson Cowie.
Brother, can you spare a dime? Once I built a tower up to the sun, brick and rivet and lime. Once I built a tower, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once in khaki suit.